This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is a sort of a therapeutic society, and I'm not a therapist. I'm a realist. And the reality of the situation is that we don't have a coherent consensus in our culture about what we're going to do.
This week's guest on Sea Change Radio is author and futurist James Howard Kunstler. In his numerous articles and books, he paints a future that involves rather drastic changes to business as usual for humankind. His most recent article in Orion magazine, Back to the Future, attempts to punch holes in the theories of urbanists like Harvard economist Edward Glaser, who believe that increased, more efficient urbanization can be a life raft for a human race that has already depleted many of Earth's treasures. In our talk today, you'll hear Kunstler's own dystopian theories on the fate of suburban America, the necessary decline of global commerce, and the bumbling nature of grassroots environmental efforts. But lest this interview leave us all feeling paralyzed by gloom, Mr. Kunstler also discusses what makes him most optimistic about a post-carbon tomorrow. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is author James Howard Kunstler. His new article appears in the latest edition of Orion magazine. It's called Back to the Future. He's the author of numerous books, including his most recent one, The Long Emergency. Jim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, it's nice to be here, Alex.
First, tell our listeners a little bit about the premise behind this piece, Back to the Future.
Well, it was sort of prompted by a lot of stuff that's been published about the future of the city, which I tended to disagree with, and I wanted to write an article about my version of the future of the city, which is quite different from most of the chatter out there.
What is some of the chatter out there? I know that there's a Harvard professor, Ed Glaser, who's written extensively on how we're going to have more vertical cities and more concentration. You think the opposite is probable?
Yes, correct. There are a lot of utopian fantasies about the city of the future. In fact, there are just tons of them, and they tend to be sort of hyper-techno-triumphant. And Ed Glaser's is one of them, and he got a lot of publicity in the spring because he came out with a new book called Triumph of the City, and it was all about how we were going to build more skyscraper cities. And if there's one thing I'm actually quite adamant about, it's the idea that the skyscraper is an obsolete kind of building or type of building, and that there are a number of reasons why we're probably not going to be able to really support a whole lot more of them or maintain them or keep building them.
And you write in the article, you say, many people seem to think that there will be more of everything, more people, taller skyscrapers, greater suburbs, bigger airplanes, larger metro regions, or even super gigantic slums. And you don't really agree with that vision, correct?
Well, there are parts of it that I think are understandable. One is that even as the world gets into rather severe trouble with resource scarcities and problems with capital and money that are related to that, and as populations suffer as a result of that, people are still going to have sex and produce children. So there will be probably increased population growth even as the world gets into terrible trouble at the margins over these issues. However, because of those problems with resources and in capital, and by that I mean oil and fossil fuels generally, I think we're going to lose our ability to keep on expanding the cities for the simple reason that the systems that keep them alive are not going to really be maintained. We're not going to have the capital or the resources to maintain the systems. So we're going to have to rethink how this is going to play out. It's probably not going to be a very orderly process. There's probably going to be a certain amount of pain and disorder in the process. But on the whole, what we're facing is a kind of comprehensive contraction of human activity on this planet.
In the face of this contracting population that you're talking about, you're also postulating that there's going to be more of a population dispersal and that we're going to be not concentrating into these megalopolises, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that our giant metroplexes are going to fail more or less. You know, not all together and not all at once. It's going to be kind of a corrosive process. But as that occurs, I think we'll see people leaving for the places that are scaled more realistically for the resource realities of the future and the money realities of the future. In the case, well, you know, a lot of this is related to how food production and capital and energy resources interact with each other, because one of the things that we're seeing out there now in the world is problems with food production and grain exports. These have caused political problems already in places like the Middle East and North Africa, and they're going to start. And that's sort of on the margins of the economic world, in the sense that these are the poorer places in the world. But we're going to see those problems move closer to the center of the world's economy. And as that occurs, the relationship between food production and where people live and how they live is going to change. We're going to get in trouble in the USA with industrial agriculture. We're going to have to find a new way to produce the food that Americans need. We're probably going to have to grow it closer to home, and it's probably going to require more human attention, because there will be fewer machines and less diesel oil available and fewer artificial fertilizers and all these inputs that we need, including capital. You know, capital, money, is one of the major inputs for industrial agriculture. So among other things, I believe we will see people leave the suburbs. It's not going to happen all at once, but the suburbs are going to be, you know, suburbia is going to become increasingly dysfunctional. And it's going to lose value, and it's going to lose its usefulness. And people are going to not hang in there forever. You know, they're going to start making choices to go elsewhere.
So you think people are going to go elsewhere, or do you think there's going to be mass famine and population reduction?
I think we will see the human population on this planet level off and then drop. But I think we're going to get into political and economic trouble before that happens. And as it's occurring. And so what I'm describing now is, you know, people that suburbia will become dysfunctional. Not everybody's going to be moving back to the big city. That's one of the mistakes that a lot of people make in their visions of the city of the future, is that, you know, everybody will just move to the city and become urban. But, you know, places like virtually all of the metroplexes in the USA, you know, whether it's Manhattan or Washington or Orlando or Atlanta or Houston, you know, or Los Angeles, they have all achieved a scale that is not consistent with the energy realities of the future.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is author James Howard Kunstler. I actually found out about your writings through a movie that my wife and I saw a screening of called The End of Suburbia, which you play a co-starring role in, and it was very eye-opening. Can you tell our audience a little bit about some of your theories about not only the future of suburbs, but give us a little bit of a history of how they were created? It wasn't always like this in America, correct?
Oh, of course not. And, you know, I got into this because I wrote a couple of books about the fiasco of suburbia and urban design, and I got hooked up with the new urbanist reform movement. So I've been sort of involved in this stuff for 20 years. But then one couldn't fail to notice, you know, how it was connected to the whole issue of our oil supply and what the destiny of the oil economy was going to be. And, you know, it turns out that we're very close to the point where the world is producing as much oil as it will ever produce in a given year, and it's going to go down shortly. You know, we're really right at the point where consumption is starting to exceed the world's production ability.
So you're saying how the suburbs were kind of a concept that really only could be propelled in an age of cheap fossil fuels, and that people were commuting to the cities. And then some people like Ed Glaser and the trend to now seeing concentrations into these larger and larger cities are in line with your thinking that the suburbs will eventually fail and that people will move into the cities. But you're thinking one step beyond that and saying these cities cannot maintain that, and we actually have to spread out even farther, but not into a hub system like a suburb is created. Is that right?
Well, sort of, yeah. We built the suburbs and we got involved in that whole thing because we could do it, because we had a very large endowment of our own oil, and we had a lot of cheap land on a large continent that was not very populated at the time that we started to make these decisions. And so we did it. And unfortunately, societies sometimes make tragic decisions, and that was not a good decision.
This is the decision to...
to suburbanize. Yeah, it was not a good decision, but we did it. We made it. A lot of damage was done to our cities in the process. And, you know, a lot of other things sort of came along, like the way that the skyscraper distorted the city, and the way that the building industry and the architectural community promoted the skyscraper because they developed a formula for making money off of it, just as the suburban builders developed a formula for making money off of, large acreages of land.
Yeah, you talk about how in the piece, Back to the Future, my guest is James Howard Kunstler, the author, you talk about how Phoenix and Las Vegas are pretty much going to be these ghost towns eventually.
Well, I put them in a special category of places that just really are pretty hopeless. You know, they're just not going to make it. You can't produce much food around Phoenix and Tucson and Las Vegas. The water supply is very sketchy. And that's on top of all the other problems that we face with resources.
And you think that there's a lot of opportunity in the upper Great Lakes region for populations to start moving back towards. Is that right?
Well, I think that we'll see a recognition that places that are well watered are going to have value, and places that have good agricultural land will have value, and people that have good inland waterways will have value, and these are all kind of this fits the bill for the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes, which is like the freshwater Mediterranean of North America. And it's very down on its luck right now. You know, it's at a really low point in this particular cycle. But I think that that's a place that'll do better than the Sun Belt, actually. In fact, you know, I've said before, and I still believe that the Sun Belt is going to suffer economically in exact proportion to the degree that benefited from the last 40 years of the cheap oil fiesta. You know, it's now entering a cycle when it's really going to get into trouble.
Let's give God a vacation. He must be tired of it all. Rigging the game, taking the blame, 24 hours a day on call. He gave us the power to reason. He put the spark in the clay. So let's let him go for a season and start making sense today. Let's give Jehovah a breather. Maybe he'll go for a swim. We won't even pray on his holiday. Won't have to claim any favors from him.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is author James Howard Kunstler. I've heard you talk about that a lot of these alternative fuels are just fantasies, but a lot of the speculation that you're setting forth is fantasy as well. It's just a little darker. And so, I mean, we don't know. So these are all fantasies until no one can have a crystal ball and look into this. So just what are some of the things that make you feel a little less pessimistic about the future?
I'll give you examples of how it works both ways. Okay. There are certainly lots of well-intentioned and inspired individuals out there who recognize the predicaments that we're facing and recognize the mandates of reality that are going to compel us to live differently, and they're doing something about it. You know, I see young people around where I live in upstate New York, you know, not far from Western Mass, where, you know, they're going back out to the derelict dairy farms and they're getting into, you know, growing vegetables and selling them at the farmer's market. And they're trying to relearn a type of agriculture that hasn't been practiced around here for 100 years. And we're gonna see a lot more of that, I'm quite sure. And I'm inspired by it. And I meet a lot of young people who I think have their heads screwed on pretty well about what the future will require of them. And they're out there learning practical skills. You know, they realize that the future is not going to be about sitting in a cubicle and then leaving at 5 o'clock and running up your credit card. They realize that the future is going to be much more hands-on. And they're doing something about it. On the other hand, you know, the other side of the coin is I go out to a place like the Aspen Institute for their yearly environmental forum. And some of the cream of the environmental movement is out there, and the leading figures are out there. And the only thing that these guys want to talk about are all the groovy new ways that you can run cars. And they don't get it. You know, the future is not going to be about driving, whether it's electric cars or hybrid cars. It doesn't matter. We're driving too much. You know, we need to concentrate on things like walkable communities, walkable towns, you know, getting the railroad system rebuilt in America so we can get around this large continental-sized country that we're in. You know, these are the kinds of things that we'll get much more benefit out of. And yet, the point is that, you know, if the leadership of the environmental movement is talking about nothing except running cars differently, we're in trouble.
In Zurich and in other places in Europe, Zurich's been getting the headlines about it. They've actually been putting in policies to try to make it harder for people to drive, to put the pedestrians in charge of stoplights and putting underpasses instead of overpasses and putting a real time element penalty attached towards getting in your car and driving. Do you think this is something we need in the U.S., or is it too late to kind of retrofit some of our cities and exurban areas into making it harder to drive instead of pouring all of our money into improving our roads?
It is going to be hard to get to a point that Europe has been at already for a long, long time. You know, Europe did not destroy its towns and cities the way we did. You know, Europe did not pave over its countryside quite the way we did. You know, they do have suburbs there, and they do have freeways, and, you know, they have a lot of that stuff, but they didn't destroy the urban human habitat. And a lot of it still persists at a scale that's appropriate for the future. You know, we are going to be constrained by shortages of capital from reforming and rehabilitating a lot of our stuff. You know, I'm not very optimistic about the reform of suburbia. I think that it probably, a lot of it has three destinies, none of them mutually exclusive. You know, some of it will be slums, some of it will be salvage, and some of it will be ruins. It remains to be seen what is going to happen with our cities. I believe that our biggest cities are going to just have to contract quite a bit. And I think the process will be difficult. I think that they're going to have to reorganize themselves around their waterfronts if they can, especially the cities that are on inland waterways. You know, we have some reason to be a little worried about what's going to happen to our ocean ports in the event of sea level rises due to climate change. But our economy is going to become much more focused on North America as globalization withers. And globalization has begun to wither. And so when our economy is focused on the internally, we're going to have to reactivate our inland waterways and get much more serious about moving things on our navigable rivers. And we have a wonderful system that runs right through the heart of the nation. You know, the Ohio River and the Mississippi and Missouri and they're connected to the Great Lakes by canals. And you know, these are the kinds of things that we're going to have to start thinking about, and it's not something that's really on our agenda.
What do you mean by globalization has begun to wither?
Well, we're already beginning to see friction between some of the major trading partners. You know, we're having friction with China over currency issues. China has become the monopoly supplier of rare earth minerals, and they slapped a 25% tax on the export of them, and they're used for all of the advanced electronics that are made in other countries. So we're beginning to see friction over trade issues that are going to start morphing into a contest for the remaining scarce resources in the world.
Sure. When you look at global economies and the way they work, there are so many ridiculous inefficiencies. Just thinking about like the waste vegetable oil that I pick up from a restaurant here locally. If I wasn't picking it up, a lot of renderers would come and they would maybe pay this restaurant for their used cooking oil. But then they would send it across the Pacific Ocean to China, where it would be used for like dog food filler and cosmetics, and then get shipped back around the world. This is the kind of globalization no one needs, right?
Well, and these things are only really possible because we have a lot of cheap fossil fuel to move these things great distances. You know, and we're going to see a lot less of that. That's one of the reasons that I think our economy eventually, and probably sooner rather than later, is going to become by default and necessity much more internally focused on what we can produce in North America and what we can move around North America.
Living a dream. My mind's not vacant. That's how it happened, living life by the drop. That's how it happened, living life by the drop. That's how it happened, living life by the drop.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is author James Howard Kunstler. Let's get back to your criticism of the environmental movement, because I think anybody from a Amory Lovins to an Ed Glaser to you, I think ultimately want the same thing. There's two ways that people can take some of your glimpses into the future. They can walk away from it and say, hey, I'm going to start a environmentally focused radio show, or I'm going to start gardening organically and selling my goods at a farmer's market. Or they can say, you know what, we're so screwed, what's the point? And we can't we some there's a lot of people who might be paralyzed by your type of negativity in terms of not just on a personal level, but on a societal level. I don't think that it's not a criticism of you. I think it's important that people like yourself are setting forth some of these worst case scenarios, but it's important to react accordingly to it and make the best of some of these worst case scenarios.
Well, Alex, you know, this is a sort of a therapeutic society, and I'm not a therapist. I'm a realist. And the reality of the situation is that we don't have a coherent consensus in our culture about what we're going to do. So what you're seeing and what you're expressing when you talk about, you know, people who are environmentally aware doing this and doing that, that's all fine. And that's bottom up activity. And that's because we don't have any kind of, you know, overarching agreement about what a good behavior would be or what a good set of policies would be. So people are kind of bumbling around, you know, at the grassroots and the margins on their own, trying to figure out how they're going to live in the future. And that's great. You know, we need that. But we also need some kind of a larger set of agreements about, you know, what we're doing. Now, I think that you find some of those things in some European countries like Germany right now, where they do have a more coherent, comprehensive idea of where they need to go as a society. You know, it's not perfect, and there are some big holes in it. Like, you know, what are they going to do about their natural gas dependence on Russia? They don't really, they haven't answered that question.
the status quo is unacceptable in a place like Germany, but it seems to be there's a big portion of our country which feels like things are just fine and dandy the way they are.
Absolutely. You know, this is a very smug nation, you know, full of people who think that, you know, we're exceptional. Whatever currents of change are going on in the rest of the world, we're immune from that. You know, that we can just keep on chugging away and go driving to the mall and, you know, going to thank God it's Friday's restaurant and stuffing our faces with cheese sticks. And, you know, there's a large part of the country that, you know, that's their identity. They don't want that taken away from them, and they don't want anybody to rain on their parade.
You mentioned how much of the environmental movement has been counterproductive. What are some of the things that you think the movement and policymakers could be doing to be more productive?
I think that we need to put a lot of thought into what the human habitat is going to be like, what its relation is going to be to productive agriculture. I think we need to really start putting aside our fantasies about happy motoring and pay a lot more attention to walkable places. I think we need to have a real policy from the top down about how we're going to rebuild the national passenger railroad system, or we're not going to get around this continent. I think there are lots of things that we are going to do. We got to change agricultural policy so we're not subsidizing industrial agriculture at the expense of local agriculture. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to get there. And one thing I would add, you know, is that societies really tend to be emergent organisms. They change their behavior in response to the circumstances that history and reality present to them. And you don't necessarily just sit there and plot out exactly what is going to happen to your society.
But big societal change, if you look at just the last 100 years, it tends to be these movements usually have a face, whether it be Lenin or Gandhi or when you were talking about how a lot of people are doing what they can and wherever they can to try to make a difference, that's important, but it's obviously not a mass movement. I think when we saw in 2008 so many people getting involved in the Obama campaign who previously weren't involved in politics, that gave us a lot of hope that, yes, we could all come together. Can we put a face on the green movement?
Well, I'm afraid that these changes, these epochal changes that occur in societies are often convulsive. You know, they take the form of revolutions or periodic breakdowns. And I'm a little bit suspicious of mass movements and putting a face on it. I don't want to put a face that's like the face of Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler on the predicament that we face now. But, it's hard to be confident about the democratic response at the moment because, as I said, we're not succeeding in constructing a consensus that is working for us. The biggest response so far to the whole range of problems that are disturbing people in America has been the Tea Party, right? And the Tea Party is basically a right-wing response.
Right.
What I would like to ask someone like you is, where's the progressive response? How come there's no, really serious populist progressive response to any of these problems?
Well, recently, Van Jones, who's been a guest on Sea Change Radio, has introduced what he's dubbing the American Dream Movement. He's trying to put a lot of these disparate progressive movements all under one umbrella, moving towards the quote-unquote American dream.
You know something? We need to do a lot less American dreaming and a lot more American waking up. That's a very unfortunate slogan.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. James Howard Kunstler, the author. Jim, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Sway the future to the past to find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Afrocubism, Mose Allison, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEA ChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.